My subject today is Under His Wings, We Learn to Trust. Under His Wings, We Learn to Trust. To be quite honest with you, I really wrestled to try to get out of preaching this morning, not because there's a particular reason about it that I didn't want to do it, it's just I didn't feel prepared. Worked on it a good bit, but there's just so much in the book of Ruth that I didn't know how to do it justice. And it became very frustrating to me. I tinkered with several outlines trying to do a bird's eye view, a panoramic view, if you will, of the book of Ruth. It has a little bit of everything in it. It's got hardships and heartaches. It's got love and loyalty. Some have called the book of Ruth the romance of redemption. And certainly that would be a fitting title. I jotted this down as a possible outline. You could look at the book of Ruth, dividing it this way. There is a falling away. There is a famine. There's a family. A funeral. And then a future. You could look at it that way. I looked at Ruth particularly, kind of zoomed in on her, and I thought about this. How Ruth was sought, how Ruth was taught, and how Ruth was bought. And that would be one way to look at it. There's three women in the book of Ruth, and that stand out to us, of course, Naomi and Ruth and her sister Orpah. If I call her Oprah, just forgive me, all right? Naomi starts out pleasant, but when we see her in Ruth, in the book of Ruth, she becomes a bitter woman. So you have a bitter woman, you have a broken woman, and that's Oprah. She's broken because she's now separated from her sister and her mother-in-law as she decides to stay in Moab. Then, of course, you have a believing woman. You have three men. The book begins with three primary men in the book. You have Elimelech and his two sons, Milion and Chilion. But they all die in the first three verses. They're gone quick. Boaz becomes the central character as far as the man goes, but it's just so much. And then there's those incredible statements that are found. One such is on the screen today, as you'll see in a moment. But then there's that classic where Ruth looks at Naomi and says, "Entreat me not to leave thee, nor to turn from following after thee. For whether thou goest, I will go. Whether thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, thy God, my God. And where thou diest, there will I be buried." Ruth says that to Naomi. And so it is both poetry and prose. It is like it reads in some Shakespearean style in some ways, and yet in other ways it becomes extremely practical and very poignant. It is an incredible book. It's only four chapters, I think around 100 verses, but it is invaluable to our understanding of how God worked in a time frame, even in the moment or the history of that surrounded Ruth, right up until Jesus was born. There is a Jesus connection in the book of Ruth, as I hope to get to in just a little bit. So you see my struggle. I didn't know where to start. I didn't know which one to pick. And so late last night, so I did something I haven't done in a while. I decided to pull up some sermons from preachers that know a lot more than I do about it. And I listened to three or four sermons, and they were all good sermons, but they weren't me. And so finally, I just sat down and started doing what I do. And when I got through with it, I said, "I like that one." I hope it comes out that way this morning, all right? Because there is a wonderful truth here that I think can help any person, no matter where you are in your life today. Ruth chapter 2 and verse 12. I want you to trust me a little bit this morning. Don't trust me entirely. I hope in your leisure you'll take time to go and read verses that I don't have time to read for you. But if we looked at all of the verses, we'd spend a lot of time there. So I'm having to just take excerpts as we try to get through this narrative together. Now, I'm picking up the story here. Ruth has met Boaz, who will eventually be her husband, and he will redeem her, as I'll explain in a moment. And they've gotten acquainted now, and he's learned about her. He's understood her situation in life. He recognizes that under Old Testament law, the levirate marriage allows him the right to marry her. Levirate is from the word levirai, the Latin word husband. And what would happen is in the Old Testament law, Mosaic law, if a husband died, the brother-in-law had a legal option or a right to marry her. And so that was very common. And so Boaz was in line. He was not the next in line, but he was in line to be her redeemer because of his kinship to her. But they've gotten to know each other, as I said. And a lot has taken place when you get to chapter 2 and 12. But then Boaz says to her, this is what has drawn him to her. This is what he finds so radiant about her. This is that special something-something that she has that is unlike the others that he's seen. He said, the Lord recompense thy work, and a full reward be given thee of the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings thou art come to trust. You know, Ruth, you've had a hard life, but you have made the right choice when you have decided to put your life under the wings of Jehovah God. You have committed your way to Him, and now, under those wings, you, in His time, are going to be rewarded, recompensed, for your work. Now, what is meant by that phrase, under his wings? Does God have wings? Well, it is figurative language, of course. You remember when Jesus was weeping over Jerusalem, he said that he had gathered them together like a hen would gather her chickens under her brood, under her wings, and hold them there. That's where the smaller fowl find warmth and safety. They're protected. They're nurtured there under those wings. Now, in the Old Testament, the Ark of the Covenant in the tabernacle, it sat there. It was this chest, and it had this gold lid on top of it. And inside that ark was the table of stone, the tablets, the Ten Commandments, the law of God. And on each side of the ark, you had cherubs that kind of face down over the ark, and they had wings. Now, we're told that the wings on these cherubs were 7.5 feet each one, so each cherub would have a wingspan of 15 feet. And the Bible clearly says that the two cherubs together had a wingspan of 30 feet. And so this was a fascinating structure to behold. And so hovering now over the mercy seat, the Ark of the Covenant, these cherubs with this beautiful wings that were that spanned 30 feet hovering, and that is where we're told the Shekinah glory of God would come and rest upon that mercy seat at certain times. God's glory would be manifested there. And so I believe that he's saying, listen, certainly Ruth probably didn't understand it, not at this point, but perhaps Boaz did when he said, hey, now you are in a place now where you are going to experience the glory. You're going to experience God. You're going to know him in a real and a personal way. And he's going to reward you for your work. He's going to take care of your life. You have come under his wings and you're learning to trust, and life is going to turn around for you. And certainly it did. And so what I'm talking to you about this morning is how to get there. How to get your life in a position where it could be said of you that I have come under his wings. I am in his presence. I'm drawing from his strength, and I'm learning to trust regardless of the circumstances of my life. Now, if you know anything about Ruth, then you know that Ruth, by her birth, by her nature, had no real hope to ever get in a position like that. Ruth was a Moabite. Now, a Moabite, they were under a curse by God. They were the descendants of an incestuous relationship that Lot had with his own daughters. And God cursed this tribe. As a matter of fact, they were not allowed in the sanctuary or around any religious ceremony for up to 10 years worth of generations. I mean, that's just how vile God saw this sin of the Moabites. And so she is a Moabite. She's a woman. That doesn't help her, not in these days. As a matter of fact, it's the time of the judges. Now, this is actually an appendix, Ruth is, to the book of Judges. It's kind of the calm and the storm. You know, the book of Judges is written because there's no king in Israel, and everybody does whatever they think is right in their own eyes, regardless of what that is. And what you, if you read the book of Judges, you see this whole cycle taking place where you see that the people are getting right with God, and then they fall away from God and into idolatry. Then God brings an army from a foreign country in to chastise them. Then God will raise up a judge to deliver them, one like Gideon that I spoke about the other night. He did that with Deborah also, the first woman judge, and of course with Samson. But it's a cycle all through the book. You know, they get right with God, then they backslide, then God brings an army in and chastises them, and then God raises up a judge. But everybody, there's no structure, there's no order, and brutality is rampant. As a matter of fact, there's a woman in the book of Judges, several graphic scenes there, but her name is Jael. I think that's the correct pronunciation, J-A-E-L. But anyway, here an enemy runs into her tent, Sisera. He comes in there. He is the captain of the army that was in invading Israel. And he's out of breath. He says, "Give me something to drink, woman." And she gives him some milk to drink. And she says, "Lay down here and rest a little bit." And so he does. She takes some covers and she puts the covers over him and gets him quiet. And he falls off to sleep because he's been on the run. She picks up a hammer and a nail. And she goes over there, and I love the way the King James says this, said she very softly, now as long as you do it real soft, she softly took the hammer and the nail and drove it into one of his temples. Then she softly picked up the other nail and drove it into the other temple. Now, she wasn't a violent woman. She did this softly, you understand? But she killed this man, and she became a heroine in the land. There's another occasion where, if you'll excuse me for saying so, but it's a fact of history, there's gang rape that takes place. It's just a terrible, terrible, terrible culture. There's no king in Israel. Every man is doing what they think is right in their own eyes. And now when the book of Ruth starts, it starts off telling us about a famine because now God is bringing some more judgment on the land because they're simply not right with God. And so that's where you get, I mean, that's where we are. And Ruth is, like I said, it's an appendix to Judges, but it's kind of like God showing us, even in the midst of all of the crime and all of the culture and all of the problems, this is what a person still can know, still can have, in the most difficult time. If you come under his wings and learn to trust, God can take care of everything. So let me give it to you this way. Ruth, first of all, when you meet her in the scriptures, her heart is heavy. She's introduced to us with a heavy heart. She's a woman in great pain. Now, why is she in pain? Well, her husband's dead. And it's been a difficult time for her. Her mother-in-law lost her husband. Her sister has lost her husband. All of the men in her life that ever loved her or was good to her, they were gone. They were buried. They were dead. She is, first of all, a woman in pain. Not unlike many of us today that have a measure of pain in our life. As a matter of fact, I don't know anyone that's ever been used of God that didn't have at some point some kind of pain interjected into their life. As a matter of fact, I can't even understand people that have never had pain. I can't relate to you. I'm not criticizing you or being ugly or facetious with you. I can't relate to you if you've never known pain. I will say this. Your Pollyanna opticism is annoying to me. I don't know how to relate to you. You've never had pain. You've never had your heart broken. You know, whatever I am, whatever success that I have had, I would say most of it's been attributed to the pain in my life. And that is the absolute truth. And it just seems to me that that's the way God fashions vessels. You know, he breaks them. And, you know, we take a vessel that is broken and we discard it. But God sets us on the shelf until we are broken. Now, she is a woman in pain. She's living in a new land. She's experiencing new customs. And it's all drained her emotionally. She doesn't know the language. She doesn't know which way to go. She's just taking a leap of faith with a very heavy heart. She is, first of all, a woman whose heart is heavy. It's the pain in her heart. But then there is the shame in her life. She feels a great deal of shame. Now, why does she feel shame? Well, because everybody that knows her knows there's the Moabite woman. I think it's 8 times in these 4 chapters, it's Ruth the Moabite. Even when you find her showing up in the genealogy of Jesus Christ in the book of Matthew, there goes Ruth, that Moabite. And so her background and that stigma is attached to her life. And so she carries not just pain, but she carries some shame. Some of you may be here today and you feel stigmatized by something in your life that's taking place. And they say, oh, yeah, there goes that person. You know, they had a divorce, or, you know, this person had a failure, or this person, they had some problems with substance, or this person's child did this, or this person's did that. And you know, we've all had things that embarrass us. And sometimes people look on and leer at that. And they like to try to exacerbate the shame that you may feel for whatever personal trauma that you've gone through in your life. Ruth could understand you well. She's that Moabite. You know what God said about the Moabites? He said, they're my wash pot. That's how fed up God was with these people, generally speaking. Obviously, he loved Ruth and loved anyone that would come to him. But generally speaking, he said, Moab is my wash pot. Now, you'd have to understand the way the Orients washed themselves. They didn't like to get in standing water. It wasn't about taking baths. They liked to have water running over them. And so they would use a basin. And the basin there, for example, on the floor, they put their feet in there. And, you know, the feet, when you're traveling, especially with sandals in the desert and in the places where there's a lot of dirt around, the feet's going to be probably the dirtiest part of your body. And so you'd take, you'd step into the basin, and then the servant would pour the water over the feet and, of course, clean the feet off. And what's left in the pot is the filth of the world. And so God says, that's what Moab is. They represent the residue of filth in this world. My washpot. Ruth is that Moabite woman. She's in pain and she's feeling shame. A third thing about her, if you would, blame. You know, Naomi, I love that name, Naomi. It's just, to me, it's a pretty name. I mostly like it because of what it means pleasant. Brother Lazarus's wife, Sammy, and she's an Egyptian by birth, and so it's Sammy for short for something. But I really enjoyed being around her. You met her when they came and shared with us. And Brother Marty, I nicknamed her Naomi because she was always so pleasant. And Lazarus was always such a grouch. You know, he was difficult. He's one of the most wonderful missionaries I've ever known. But what I mean, he still had a lot of that ancient custom in him where women were, I don't know. Yeah, well, thanks. You know, I looked to Marty to just get to the point. But they were kind of second rate. And so I'd watch her, but she just kept such a pleasant spirit all of the time. But now, Ruth hears her tell her friends when they get back in Bethlehem, "Don't call me pleasant anymore. Call me bitter." You don't think Ruth felt a little guilty about that? Yeah, I know why you're bitter. I know because you came to my country and you met my family and I married your sons and now they're dead and your husband's dead and my sister's gone and it just human nature would make you conclude that she may have felt some blame for how meeting her had changed her life. Her heart is heavy. That's how she's introduced to us in the scriptures. The second thing I want you to see about her is Ruth's home life is very hard. What happens is after 10 years and the last man in the family dies, Naomi hears that there's food in Bethlehem of Judea. And she decides that she's going to go home. Matter of fact, the word Bethlehem actually means the house of bread and praise. And she's been here for a long time. She's been here 10 years, and she has lost everything she loved in the world. And so, but it's interesting, when she comes back home, you know what she says? She said, "I went out full, and I came home empty." I was laying down last night thinking about that. Wait a minute, Naomi, you went out full. You went out because there was a famine. You didn't have anything to eat. How is it that you could say you went out full, you came home empty? Because when you left because you're destitute and poor. She learned in Moab that how to appreciate the blessings of God. What I'm trying to say is, she was really full when she thought she was empty. You know? Because she had everything she loved. She had what mattered. You know? Didn't have as much food to eat as she would like to have had. And her living conditions were probably not that good. But she said, "You know, I had Elimelech. And the man's name means, "My God is King." What a family. Can you imagine? Here is the husband, "My God is King." Naomi, pleasant. That's a sweet home. But not without hardship. They bear Milion and Chilion. And one means weak and the other means pining. They're both sickly from birth. So even in this godly home, these children are broken. But when she spends time in the world and sees what it really has to offer, she concludes, "Hey, I was full when I thought I was empty." I wonder sometimes when you and I come to the end of the road and we've lived our life, and a lot of the things that we've worried about, we've pined over, we've complained and murmured about, I wonder how important they will be. You know, I said to Cinda a few weeks ago, I said, "You know, if you knew that you only had 10 more years to live," that's not a long time, "but if you knew you only had 10 more years to live, what would be the most important things in your life? Would they be your job? Would they be making a certain amount of money? Would they be having a certain circle of friends? What would really be important if this was the last run? You knew that your race was nearly run. You know, you might find out that the things that you'd really want to take care of are the things that you're neglecting right now." Ruth says, "I went out full, I came home empty." Excuse me, Naomi said that. So now, when she's there, she's going to live with her mother-in-law. But the home life is hard. Once pleasant, now it's hard. Why is it hard? Well, poverty's a problem. They don't have any money. There's no man to work. There's no food. Life's hard. I mean, let me tell you something. Poverty is difficult. People that suffer poverty. Matter of fact, I read this a few weeks ago and reread it again last week. If you have a dollar in your pocket, you see, our world, we're so out of touch with what's really going on in the world. If you have $1 in your pocket, or you can get your hands on one single dollar bill, you are richer than 80% of the people that live in the world. Tonight, 2 billion people will go to bed hurting in hunger. 2 billion. They'll go to bed wishing they had something to eat. And when they get a chance to get something to eat, it won't be but a handful of this or a handful of that. We don't even know what it means to be poor anymore. But Ruth's home life here now is really, they don't have any. So it's hard, and then there's the pressure. Well, her mother-in-law's bitter now. You know, bitter people are critical people. If you're bitter, it's not just you you're affecting. You're affecting everybody around you. That's what God warned us about in His Word. He said, if bitterness is in your heart, it will spring up, it'll trouble you, and then it'll spill over and defile a lot of people. And certainly that's true. Nobody wants to be around a bitter person. I admire so much people that have great pain in their life, but yet they're not bitter about it. Sorrow is a clean wound, and it will heal right if you don't apply self-pity to it. But if you put self-pity into that wound, it will get infected and it will breed bitterness. There are people in this church today who have been had their hearts ripped by pain, traumatized by pain. But yet, when I get around them, you can tell they're strengthened. They have an unusual strength. They're, they're not bitter, though I'm sure they have their moments where they perhaps say, why Lord, or whatever, but they don't come across as bitter. I see Ann Gabrielle back there. Now, Ann and I are good friends, and if you ever hear us cutting up, she's usually cutting me down for some reason. And then she'll come up and hug me and give me a little kiss right here, and because we're friends, we love each other. But she's had her heart ripped out of her. Walked into the bedroom and found her own daughter had left her. But Anne's not bitter. She may be broken. Gina's here this morning and her dad. Gina amazes me, and I tell her, I said, you amaze me. She carries herself with grace and dignity, and I know her heart bleeds. It hurts. Can't imagine the pain. I can't imagine the pain. But it's not bitter. Broken, perhaps. Her sweet dad's here. Broken, yes. Sad, yes. But he's not bitter. God bless you people that rise above it and refuse to get bitter. Naomi said, don't call me pleasant anymore. I'm bitter. And now we're poor. And Ruth is feeling the pressure. Her mother-in-law is older. What is she going to do? How can she help turn things around? She's a Moabite. 10 generations keep her away from the house of God. It's a mess. The third thing I want you to see about her, it's not just her home life is hard and sure her heart is heavy, but as you keep reading this wonderful book, you realize that Ruth's hope gets a lot of help. Because it's like Ruth, you know, when she tells her mother-in-law, entreat me not to leave thee nor return from following after thee. I'm going wherever you go. And she recites those immortal words. There's hope there. And now she gets here and she sees the conditions and she hears what her mother-in-law says. And now she's certainly missing her own husband and perhaps her family and the culture that she knew. But she's not really without hope. But now it's flickering. Because negativity has got her surrounded. But now Ruth's hope is going to get an infusion. It's going to get help. What's going to happen? Well, the providence of God is going to take over. Oh, I love this. Because look what happens in her life. Now, she decided she's going to have to go get a job. She's going to have to go work. She's going to have to help her mother-in-law. She's going to have some, some means to feed herself and take care of her mother-in-law. So she went and came and gleaned in the field after the reapers. Now, let me stop there and say this. God had a wonderful Social Security plan for poor people. He's always taking care of the poor. And the wealthy were told by God, that law of God says, you can plow your field, get your grain, do what it is, but leave the corners like they are. Just don't bother the corners. Because people that don't have anything, let them go in there and glean. Let them go get what they need. You've been blessed beyond measure. You've got all this other here. So if you have a kinsman or people in your community that need something, you make sure you leave something in the corners where they can come and get what they need. You know, we try to operate that way at Grace Baptist Church. When we put out a budget every year, we always leave some in the corners for people that may never darken this door. Isn't that right, Mike? I mean, we increase that every year. We know people in this community are hurting, and we say, hey, we've got to increase this budget. Now, we have a much more allotted for any of our families that may hurt. We have what we call it's a line item. It's benevolence for church family, and then it's benevolence for community. And if somebody in this community is hurting, we've got some in the corners for you. It's just the way God's people should do. And so she learned about this plan. That's pretty good. I'm going to go get in the field and I'll follow after the reapers. I won't get in their way or I won't try to get what belongs to them. But whatever it is that's behind there or in those corners, I'll get what I have a legal right to. And here's what I want to show you. And her hap was to light on a part of the field belonging unto Boaz. I just got chills all over. Her hap was. Now, I wanted to preach, Marty, on this. Nothing just happens. That is how we as seekers sometimes, we go back and we tell our testimony about how we met the Lord and how we came to Christ. And we say, well, this happened and then that happened and then that happened. And it looks like happenstance or coincidence, but really it's all being governed by God. It's divine providence. I remember walking up the ramp at UA Town High School. And full of hate, full of anger, full of rage, with the biggest chip on my shoulder that you could imagine. And Steve Donaldson, who you met, he came by and he said, Frank, and Steve and I, we never talked. You know, we played ball together, but at that time, we were not friends. That's back in the day, you know, where you just walked up to somebody and said, I don't like your looks. Well, what are you going to do? You want to change them? Yeah, well, let's get it on. And you'd fight for no reason. Can't do that anymore. They pull out a gun, just kill you. But it's true. You know, you have people say, well, you know, I don't like your looks. Well, I don't give a rip. Why don't you try to change them? And then you do that. And so Steve and I were kind of like that. We were very competitive. But one day, I'm going up the ramp, and he says, hey, Frank, I went to a revival last night, and said, and I'll never forget how he said it. He said, I tied up some loose ends. And he said, there's this woman, she's a heroin addict, or had been a heroin addict. She's gonna speak tonight, and said, won't you come with me? Word of God, I don't want to go by myself. We were on the team together, but we were not friends. I said, okay. You see, he was going this way, I'm coming that way, and our hap was to speak. Then we go. And then we become really, really good friends. We were like brothers. One day, we were very religious in church, and he happens to hear Marty Few preach. He's convicted and he's saved. And, you know, when you get saved, you worry about people that are not saved that you love. And he began to talk to me about it. And Cinda was then saved. And then I was later saved. I put up a fight because I had so much pride. But my problem, all this just coming down the hallway one day. And he says, hey, you want to go to revival? Yeah. This is kind of what happens in her life. She says, I'm going to go get some of that food that belongs to us based on Mosaic law, but her hap was to light on the field that belonged to Boaz. Now, why is that significant? Well, number one, he's very rich. And number two, he's kin to her. And there's this law that says he has a right to marry her. He's much older than her. But when he sees her, and I'm not sure if I have it in my text, but when he sees her, you know what he says? Whose damsel is this? See, he happens to notice her, and she happens to be in his field. And what I'm trying to tell you is, nothing has just happened in your life. There's a purpose for it. I don't care if it was painful or pleasant. It didn't just happen. There's a reason for it. That person that came into your life, it didn't just happen. That person that left you, it didn't just happen. Nothing just happens for the Christian. And so her hope is helped now by the providence of God. So she goes home and she brings all this food in. She said, "Where have you been, Miss, you know, the woman who was formerly called Pleasant, now called Bitter?" Says, "Where'd you get that?" "I was gleaning the field." "Whose field?" "Boaz." "What? Boaz? He's kin to us." And she sets her down and she explains the law to her. And it's an amazing thing. So I got to get faster here. I'm looking at the clock here. And some of y'all are looking at your watch. And you know, it's very rude to do that. I'm trying to preach a whole book in just a few minutes. And providence of God gets your hope up. Now, then I like this little push from Naomi. Now, she's going to get involved here. You see, I don't know what Ruth looked like. You know, we kind of picture her as a pretty girl. I mean, Boaz noticed her and was intrigued. But we don't really know much about what she looked like. But Naomi's going to give her some good womanly advice. She's going to tell her how to get a man. It's pretty good stuff here. And so look at this little push she gives her. Naomi, her mother-in-law, said unto her, "Now, my daughter, shall I not seek rest for thee?" This is chapter 3. "That it may be well with thee. And now is not Boaz of our kindred, with whose maidens thou wast?" And all this is yes, yes, yes. "Behold, he weaneth barley tonight in the threshing floor." I happen to know that he's working the night shift. And I like this. Watch it. He says, go take you a bath. That's the first advice I'd give to any man or woman. If you're going on a date, clean yourself. I'm serious. Brush your teeth. Clean yourself. Put your little cologne on or a little perfume. Never hurt. That's what she said. "Anoint thee. Put thy raiment upon thee." I want you to get that good-looking outfit out. Take your bath. Put your little perfume on. "And get thee down to the floor." Now, it doesn't mean what you think that means. That's the threshing floor where he's working. But don't, now see, don't go down there looking all desperate. You know? "But make not thyself known unto the man." You know, she didn't have a lot of confidence in her looks. As, you know, making sure he's drunk before he sees you good up close. I'm kidding. Well, he's been working. Make sure he's eating and make sure he's drinking. Make sure he's relaxed. I'm going to tell you, timing's everything. When you're trying to confront any situation, timing is everything. I could preach on that, but I got to get going here. So next verse, okay. "And it shall be when he lieth down, thou shalt mark the place where he shall lie, and thou shalt go in and uncover his feet and lay thee down, and he will tell thee what thou shalt do." Now, this was the customary. You see, what she's doing here is she's presenting herself to him. She is saying to Boaz, and they've already talked. Remember in chapter 2, he's bragged on her for learning to trust God. And so they've gotten to know each other. But now Naomi's given her a little push, and she goes and she puts herself in position to where she's wanting basically to surrender herself, her life, to him. She wants to be his wife. And he said unto her, "And thou sayest unto me," and she said unto her, "All that thou sayest unto me, I will do." Good girl. "And she went down into the floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law bade her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of the corn." He's tired, worn out. "And she came in softly, uncovered his feet, and laid her down. And it came to pass at midnight that the man was afraid, turned to himself, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. And he said unto said, Who art thou?" I remember back when I was visiting, back when Seth was spending some time in Vesper at the foundry and some time ago, and I'd come in really, really late at night. And I'd be up there a lot when my dad was going through that, and he was going through that. And so I come in one night, and Cinda's always been able to sleep just hanging on a nail, you know. You just put her on there, she falls asleep. So I walk in, I'm trying not to wake her or anything, and she's startled like Boaz, and she says, you know, who is that? I said, it's whoever you want me to be, darling. But my heart was broken when she told me who she thought it was. He says, who are you? I'm Ruth, thy handmaiden. Spread therefore thy skirt over thine handmaiden, for thou art a near kinsman. In other words, I belong to you. We're supposed to be together. Take me in this moment and make me yours. And he said, blessed be thou of the Lord, my daughter, for thou hast showed more kindness in the latter end than at the beginning, insomuch as thou followest not young men, whether poor or rich. Boaz says, me? You see, that so blew his mind that now he is going to make plans. And I gotta go. But look, watch this last point and we'll be done. So her hope is helped because she gets this little push from Naomi. But now Boaz makes the plans. He steps up and does what men do. He says in chapter 3 and verse 11, and now, my daughter, fear not. I will do to thee all that thou requirest. For all the city of my people doth know that thou art a virtuous woman. And there's so much more to the story, but I want to read this from the Living Bible, and I'll be through that same verse. You see, there was a little bit of a problem. There was someone a little closer kin than Boaz, and so Boaz had to go meet him and see if he could pay what it took to do it, and the guy was not interested in her, and then Boaz was able to pay the price and make her his wife. So there's some complications there, but this is what he tells her in verse 11. Now, don't worry about a thing, my child. I'll handle all the details. You know, that's the thing. Wherever you've been in your life, whatever's taken place, when you just finally put yourself at the feet of your divine Boaz and you ask him to spread his righteousness over you and cover you with his love. The wonderful thing about Jesus is he says, now don't you be afraid anymore. I'm going to handle all the details. You've come under my wings. You're going to learn to trust. What a beautiful thing. You know, Keith, if you'll come and get our song ready. Let me just say this as we close. I read this. I don't know if it's a true story because I don't know much about farming and things like that, but it was told as true. But there was this farmer that had the chickens and, you know, in the hen house and all, and the thing caught on fire. And the mother hen was burned. She died. And when he's walking through the rubble and he takes his foot and kind of just, you know, kind of tosses the hen out of the way, he looks and here come these little chickens just hopping out. And that fire, that mother hen reached up and took her wings and she pulled those little chicks up under her brood there and she died saving them. That's what Jesus did for us. He saw us all in trouble. He saw us all with a life that's going to have a measure of pain, a measure of heartache. It's going to be difficult at times. But, and of course, then we had sin. And so he stretched out his hands and he gathered us in there and he took our punishment on the cross. And now we live today because he died in our place. He handled all the details. The only thing he asked you to do this morning is to respond to his call. He said, come unto me, all ye that labor and heavy laden, I'll give you rest. He said, whosoever would call upon the name of the Lord, you'll be saved. Come on under my wings, he says, and learn to trust. You know, that could mean that, you know, when you're a child, you got your mom, you got your dad, then you got other people in your life, and this person gets important, this person, and you just kind of go through life, and you kind of lean on this person, you lean on that person, you lean on this one, lean on that one, and that's natural and normal. But as you live life longer, this person moves away, or this person dies, or this friendship kind of just deteriorates and runs its course. And if all you've ever done is gone through life learning to lean on this one and learning to lean on this one and learning to lean on that one, and eventually when they're all taken away from you, what are you going to do then? Why don't you come under the wings of the one that will never leave you and learn to trust him? And if he can take the Moabite and put her in the family of God, and that's where you find her in Matthew chapter 1. She's in the family of God. Let me tell you something about this girl Ruth, and I'm sorry, I promise I won't shut up. But look, here's what happens. She marries Boaz. They have a child named Obed. Obed has a child named Jesse. Jesse has a child named David. Now Israel's got him a king from that Moabite woman. Great things happen when you come under his wings and learn to trust. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, I pray that in this moment now, every heart would just examine their own life and where we have failed to trust you like we should, and where we have been like Naomi, not appreciative when we were really full and we felt we were empty, and all those experiences that sometimes beat us up in life. Put our focus on you, as Daryl sang a moment ago. Let us lift up our eyes and look at you. Help every hurting heart, Lord, that is struggling now, Lord. Just, they feel like they're just eking out existence. I've been there before. I have my days like that. Remind us, Lord, that you hover over us, and you told us that we could mount up with wings like eagles. Help us to come under that power of your presence and that protection that you make available to us. And trust you that in time will happen upon that place where life will turn around. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Will you stand as we sing?